The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The roster of presidential candidates keeps getting longer. Just over the past week, several more contenders have made it official. Yesterday, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee joined the expanding group. And as he did in his presidential bid 6 years ago, Huckabee paid tribute to his humble roots in the town of Hope, Arkansas.
So it seems perfectly fitting that it would be here that I announce that I am a candidate for president of the United States of America.
Before Huckabee, earlier this week, former high-tech CEO Carly Fiorina said she was in, offering Republicans their only woman candidate and showing a willingness to tackle the other female in the race, Hillary Clinton.
She shouldn't be president of the United States because she's demonstrated over and over again that she's not trustworthy and she doesn't have a track record of accomplishment or leadership.
Meanwhile, Democrats will have a primary. Late last week, Vermont U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders joined Clinton in that contest, with Sanders highlighting his longtime populist message.
We can't continue having a nation in which we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major nation on earth at the same time as we're seeing a proliferation of millionaires and billionaires.
This hour on The Exchange, political junkie Ken Rudin helps us sort through these and other political stories. Each month, Ken joins us with his veteran observer's eye on the political news of the nation. Let's hear from you, too. Your questions and comments for Ken are welcome at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ken, welcome back. Great to have you. Happy May.
Happy May indeed, and I love listening to Bernie Sanders' Vermont accent. I just love it.
You can take the boy out of New York, but not the New York out of the boy.
Brooklyn, right.
So before we get into all the stuff that's been going on, and boy, we've seen a lot of candidates here in the Granite State, do you have a trivia question for us, Ken?
Yes, and the answer is Margaret Chase Smith.
That was the answer last month and the month before.
Exactly. Okay, Martin O'Malley is the former mayor of Baltimore, and he's obviously talking about running for president. Who was the last former mayor nominated for president by one of the two major parties?
Okay, again, the number in the exchange for you to answer the trivia question, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We're giving you a hint. The answer is not Margaret Chase Smith. The question again is, given that former mayor of Baltimore, Martin O'Malley, is preparing to run for president, who is the last former mayor nominated, not just running, but nominated for president by a major party? If you think you know the answer, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, wow, Ken, a busy presidential week. I'm starting to lose track of who's in, who's out. What's the count up to at this point?
Well, the count is up to six, and it's doubled in just in Monday and Tuesday alone, as you pointed out. Carly Fiorina and Ben Carson, the retired neurosurgeon, announced on Monday, and Mike Huckabee, the former governor of Arkansas, announced yesterday. That comes to six. And, of course, there are more Republicans waiting in the wings. Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, maybe Bobby Jindal, maybe Rick Santorum, maybe Rick Perry, and maybe Chris Christie, although we'll talk about what the latest indictments do for his campaign or not do for his campaign.
Well, definitely want to ask you a little bit later, you know, who are we still waiting for and what are they waiting for? But so let's talk about who's in just yesterday, the return of Mike Huckabee. How is Huckabee 2016, Ken, different from Huckabee 2008?
Well, the difference may not be with Mike Huckabee. He's still an evangelical, folksy kind of guy. You know, he was a Baptist minister before he was elected governor. He's in Arkansas. He served for governor more than 10 years, and he was a very popular governor and not the most conservative governor. And, of course, he raised taxes in Arkansas. And conservatives, like the group Club for Growth, will say he's not a true conservative because of higher spending and higher taxes. But he's very folksy. He's charming. But even if he's this, even if Mike Huckabee is the same in 2015 and 16 as he was in 2008, the terrain is different in the sense that there are multimillionaires out there who are very ready to give, to open up their own checkbooks on behalf of their favorite candidate. And right now, it doesn't look like that Mike Huckabee has any of those financial angels at his on his side. We heard during his announcement yesterday that he's asking for people to send in $15 a month, $25 a month. I mean, that made sense maybe in 1924, but right now that's going to mean nothing given the millions and millions of dollars that are being raised by the other potential candidates.
Wow. So there's sort of the money primary bigger and more intense than just 6 years ago, Ken. Is that
what
you're saying?
Well, that's always been the case. You know, every year we said, boy, we've never had a campaign this expensive. And that's true. And that's true. And of course, you know, you could say that the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision accelerated that. But every cycle is more and more expensive. And 2016. Look, Hillary Clinton is talking about raising $2.5 billion. I mean, you don't make that in 3 years at NHPR. So I kind of think that that's a lot of money there.
Well, and Ken, we've got a couple people who think they know the answer to your trivia question for us this month. Again, who was the last former mayor nominated for president by a major party? If you think you know the answer, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, it's our check-in with Ken Rudin. We check in with Ken once a month to review some of the top political stories of the nation. And Ken, let's go to Linda Newfield. Hi, Linda, do you think you know the answer?
Well, it's a kind of a blind guess. I really wanted to ask Ken a question about funding for all these Republicans who are running. But I guess I'll give him my answer. I think it's Al Smith, who, as I recall, was mayor of New York City and then ran way back.
Linda, we'll keep you on the line so you can ask about campaign finance. But Al Smith, Ken, is that the answer?
Al Smith was governor of New York, but he was never mayor of New York City. So it's not Al Smith. Al Smith, of course, was the first Catholic to run for president in 1928. He lost to Herbert Hoover, but never a mayor.
All right. Well, Linda, thank you very much for calling in. And let's go next. Here's an email from Ray, who says, how about Thomas Dewey?
Thomas Dewey was district attorney of Manhattan, and then he, like Al Smith, was also governor of New York, but never mayor.
Okay. Thank you for that try, Ray. We appreciate it. And let's take Jack in Kempton. Hi, Jack. You're on the Exchange with Ken Rudin.
Well, good morning. How about the mayor of Minneapolis, Hubert Humphrey?
Hubert Humphrey is the correct answer. In 1948, he was elected to the Senate, but he was before that, he was mayor of Minneapolis. Matter of fact, when he gave a rousing speech on defense of civil rights at the 1948 convention that caused Strom Thurmond and all the Southern Democrats to walk out, he was the mayor of Minneapolis, the last former mayor to be nominated.
All right. Well, congratulations, Jack. You win the pleasure of knowing that you won the trivia prize. We'll have to figure out a prize at some point.
You know,
Ken,
something,
for folks.
I actually get Jack's address, because, and I will tell you this, Laura, that in the future, I will send you a bunch of political junkie buttons that the winners can have and either sell on eBay for a ton of money or just, you know, wear proudly.
All right. Well, Jack, thank you again for calling in, and congratulations for winning the trivia prize. Our number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Join us as we cover some of the top political news of the nation. And Ken, Linda Newfield is back with us. She didn't win the trivia question, but she did have another thought on campaign finance, given what you said about Mike Huckabee. Go ahead, Linda.
Oh, thank you very much. The vast multitude of everybody running for president on the Republican side, and I guess a few on the Democratic side as well, just a few. But where are they getting funding? I mean, surely some reality must set in with some of these candidates that their best hope is to be selected maybe as a VP or maybe part of an administration of a winning Republican ticket. But where are they getting funding for this to come up here, to come up to New Hampshire, to go all over Iowa, to go all over the United States?
Right. Well, who are some of these angels that you talked about before, Ken, these financial angels? Thank you, Linda.
Yeah, Linda asks a very good question, because basically it was lack of money that forced Mike Huckabee out of the race in 2008. He had won about five or six primaries, mostly in the South. He had won the Iowa caucuses, but he ran out of money. And while Mitt Romney had the money and John McCain had the delegates, Huckabee had to drop out. Now, if you're Jeb Bush, you have a vast fundraising network, because the Bushes have been running for president since 1980. His father, of course, and his brother. So there are a lot of very extensive Bush Rolodexes that he could rely on, and he intends to do that. Scott Walker, when he the governor of Wisconsin, when there was a recall effort against him in 2012, 2 years after he was elected governor, national conservative groups rallied behind him and put together a pro-Walker and anti-labor union mailing list and fundraising apparatus that helped him do that as well. Marco Rubio, you know, and then Ted Cruz just reported that he was in Texas the other day and he raised, I think, 31 or I know there's a big difference. I can't remember the number. It was either $31 million or $61 million within a few days of announcing his candidacy. So there are millionaires out there who will support you. On the other hand, Chris Christie, and we'll talk about him in a bit, but Chris Christie had a lot of big money people when he ran for governor twice. But given his latest problems and given the fact that many of his former supporters have moved on to Bush, the question is whether a Chris Christie or a Rick Perry or somebody else like that can mount a financially adequate campaign to stay up with the big boys and the one big girl, right?
Well, and Ken, just before we head into the break, I like Linda's other point, because there was some speculation about this in our local press this week. She raised the idea that some of these candidates may not really be running for president, but more vice president or some nice slot in a new administration. What do you think?
Well, there is that, and of course, there's a lot of snarky comments. Perhaps some of it is true, but they say that a lot of them may be also running to be the next anchor or special, you know, anchor on Fox News.
Right.
So there is that, and of course, a lot of people say, I mean, Gary Hart was always thought to be running for vice president or for the next time out, but then he did so well, he became a serious candidate. So it's a combination of all of it. But, you know, lightning can strike, as Jimmy Carter learned in 1976, and I guess Republicans don't want to hear these words, but they hope to be the next Jimmy Carter.
All right. Well, Linda, again, thank you for joining us. You can give us a call, too. It's our monthly check-in with political junkie Ken Rudin, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Coming up, lots more candidates to go through. Carly Fiorina, Ben Carson, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, Martin O'Malley, Chris Christie. We'll talk about all that coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Political junkie Ken Rudin is with us this hour. We check in with Ken once a month on some of the nation's top political stories. We've been looking at an increasingly crowded presidential race, and we'd love your thoughts, questions, comments on that. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. A little bit later in the hour, we'll also look at the politics of Baltimore as our nation's political leaders and those who want to be political leaders give their take on the unrest in that city. 1-800-892-6477, again, is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Well, Ken, a couple firsts for the Republican field, or onlys, I should say. An African-American officially made it as a presidential candidate on the Republican side this week. Tell us a little bit about Ben Carson.
Well, Ben Carson, if he's elected, would be the first African-American president since Barack Obama. He's a former neurosurgeon, a pediatric neurosurgeon who's very acclaimed in his field. In 2013, I think it was at a national prayer breakfast where he really lit into, and President Obama was attending it, he lit into the president by talking about how the government has made everybody dependent on big government and they should be more self-sufficient. Now, he's an interesting speaker. He has a great story to tell. His mother did not go past the third third grade. They came up from poverty. They spent a long time living in places like Baltimore and Detroit and has a great story to tell. But as any first candidate will tell you, that they are prone to be making mistakes. And while Ben Carson tries to excite conservative crowds, he'll say some things that might to some people sound a little bit out of whack. There was one speech where he, in the same sentence, he compared same-sex marriage to pedophilia and bestiality, which got a good applause from the audience, but some people, you know, roll their eyes on that. He once said that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is the worst thing to happen to America since slavery. Again, when you're giving a speech before a excited crowd, your rhetoric can be a bit exciting, but sometimes you just have to watch what you say as a first-time candidate.
Well, and as you said, Ken, the idea that social welfare programs are not playing a positive role in society is a major theme of Ben Carson's campaign. Let's hear what he said.
There are many people who are critical of me because they say Carson wants to get rid of all the safety nets and welfare programs, even though he must have benefited from them. This is a blatant lie. I have no desire to get rid of safety nets for people who need them. I have a strong desire to get rid of programs that create dependency in able-bodied people.
Again, that's Ben Carson from his announcement speech announcing his bid for the Republican nomination for the presidency. You know, Ken Rudin, last question on Ben Carson, because we have a lot of other candidates to talk about. But you mentioned that he really has fired up some crowds and gotten some people excited. In his announcement, though, he was very low key, very slow, very deliberate, had his eyes closed half the time.
As did I. No, that's not fair. No, look, the thing is, what's interesting about that, his announcement speech was over a half hour in length. I believe, just from watching it, there was no teleprompter, there were no notes. He just spoke off the cuff, and the audiences do like that. But, of course, I would imagine a debate between Ben Carson and Joe Biden might, take several days rather than an hour or so. But people complain
there's not enough, long-form substance. So there you go.
Well, I'm not complaining about that. I mean, in our desire for instantaneous satisfaction, you're not going to get it from Ben Carson. But he has a story to tell, and he will tell it to anyone who will listen.
Well, again, the number here in the exchange for you to join us, political junkie Ken Rudin, is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Ken, Carly Fiorina also made it official this week. She's been running a very busy campaign. She's everywhere on media. She's made multiple trips to New Hampshire. What stands out for you from Ms. Fiorina's campaign?
Well, other than the fact that she's the only woman in the Republican race, but Elizabeth Dole tried to be that first Republican woman in 2000, didn't get anywhere. But what's interesting about Carly Fiorina is that she is really, she certainly is running for the Republican nomination, but her goal seems to be to attack Hillary Clinton at all costs and every opportunity. And I think her feeling is maybe that as a woman, I obviously cannot be accused of gender bias because I am a woman as well. But she does go after Hillary at every opportunity, talks about her not being qualified, that would be a big mistake. And she seems to be running on her business acumen. But in fairness, and you have to point this out, but when she was the CEO at Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina fired 30,000 employees. Now, of course, it was to make the company more streamlined, but that's not the kind of record I would want to run on when I'm running for president, saying I got rid of 30,000 people. And as it turned out, the board got rid of her as well not long after. She's very good on the stump. She gives a very entertaining speech. But if we're talking about her record as a business person, you have to include the bad stuff with Hewlett-Packard as well.
Well, she did keep people entertained this week on the stump, as you said. Here she is having a little fun with the questions that some people still have about a woman in the Oval Office, but also poking fun at the mishaps during the Clinton presidency. Let's hear Carly Fiorina.
I was asked whether a woman's hormones prevented her from serving in the Oval Office. Can you think of a single instance in which a man's judgment was clouded by hormones. Ever. Including in the Oval Office.
Well, again, that's Carly Fiorina talking about issues that have come up on the campaign trail. Any further thoughts on that, Ken Rudin?
Well, you know, I mean, she is a multimillionaire. She left Hewlett Packard with a very generous severance package. Again, like Linda's question from a while ago, how is she going to stand out with all these big money givers? That's a good question. Of course, she kind of resents the fact that she's asking people that people are asking her whether she's really running for vice president. But that's not really a sexist question in the sense that almost everybody, as you pointed out, Laura, so many candidates like John Kasich of Ohio, other potential candidates are always asked that given the heavyweights. So-called heavyweights in the race, are you really running for vice president? But you look, she has it right now with 9 months to go before New Hampshire. It's only 9 months, which is pretty remarkable.
Right.
Right now, she has a chance. I mean, there's no front runner. The polls don't have anybody with a lead. Why not Carly Fiorina?
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Ken, here's an email from William. He says, what about James Webb and John Kasich? William says, they seem better qualified than anyone currently running. You just mentioned John Kasich, former governor of Ohio or still current governor of Ohio?
Currently the governor, still the governor, and who won a landslide re-election in 2014.
And former congressman also.
Former chairman of the House Budget Committee, right.
Right. And James Webb, just remind us.
James Webb is a Democrat, the former senator, one-term senator from Virginia. He has an exploratory committee. He's out in Iowa. As a matter of fact, I think he's in Iowa this week. And hoping to run to Hillary Clinton's left. He is trying to make the same case that perhaps Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley are hoping to make, in that the Democratic nomination should not be a coronation. There should be a battle for over ideas. And Jim Webb is out there trying to share his ideas.
No, I did not know that Jim Webb was making a possible go at it. John Kasich, he came to the state, about a month ago. Is he still actively considering?
Oh, absolutely. The problem is that he's kind of like he's campaigning as a compassionate conservative, to borrow a page from George W. Bush's playbook in 2000. He supported Common Core. His rhetoric on immigration is not hostile, as other candidates are. And of course, you know, winning a landslide in a big state like Ohio, and everybody knows that no Republican has ever been elected president without winning Ohio. So Kasich would make the argument that why not me? But in many ways, he is just like Jeb Bush. He doesn't represent much different than Bush. And again, you're going to have to need a lot of money. And right now, the question is whether John Kasich can raise the money.
All right. Well, thanks for that email, William. And here's another one from Ray in Whitefield. He says, I think Bernie is going to surprise many pundits. There is much angst and disillusioned voters out there. And Mr. Sanders offers a progressive alternative. Thanks for the email, Ray. Let's talk about Bernie Sanders. He also jumped in recently.
He did, and you know something about Bernie Sanders. Do I think he has a shot for the nomination? Well, nobody does, and that's what makes it interesting. Because if you look at all the controversies swirling around Hillary Clinton, and there are many, and we could talk about that, but for all the controversies, she's still leading by huge margins in every poll. But there's no question that there was a dissatisfaction out there among progressive Democrats that they feel that Hillary Clinton may be too close to the banks, too close to Wall Street, too close to corporate America. And, of course, her comments on the need for a more muscular foreign policy turns off a lot of progressives who were just so weary about Iraq and Afghanistan and all that. Bernie Sanders is campaigning. Basically, Bernie Sanders is trying to, I don't know if he's consciously doing this, but all the people who wanted Elizabeth Warren to run, and of course Elizabeth Warren looks like she's not going to run, Bernie Sanders is using the same kind of language that Elizabeth Warren would have run, in that income inequality is unacceptable in this country, that neither party is doing much to deal with it. And just the other day when Bernie Sanders got up on the floor in the Senate and said, how dare the Republicans talk about cutting taxes, but then he says, but there are people in my own party who's doing that. So he's a true independent. He's not a Democrat, and maybe that could hurt him in some Democratic primaries. But he says, look, I offer a voice that is not being heard and that desperately needs to be heard.
Well, and you're right. He is officially an independent in Congress, but he's running as a Democrat in this presidential race. Right, Ken?
Right. And I don't know if there are state laws that say you have to run as you have to be a Democrat to run the Democratic primary. He has said that I will deal with it as necessary. If I have to declare myself as a Democrat to run an X primary or X caucus, he'll do so.
Wow. Lots to talk about this month. It's time to check in once a month with political junkie Ken Rudin. You can join us. We'd love your questions, comments, and thoughts on some of the top political stories that we're talking about with Ken, including the ever-expanding list of presidential candidates who are making their way to the Granite State. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Ken, let's go to Kevin in Bedford. Hi, Kevin. You're on the Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Laura. Love your show. Listen to it every day. Ken, very nice to meet you on the phone, and I also listen when you participate, but like a lot of our media, I think you're leaning a little towards the liberal side. Everyone brings this 30,000 reduction in force by Carly. You know, she might have been the CEO, but there was a whole board of directors that had to vote with her. The other fact is they were trying to merge two large computer companies into one, so there was a lot of redundancy.
And that failed, too, when she tried to get Compaq into Hewlett-Packard. I'm not saying that she personally fired 30,000 people, but she was part of a corporation that, one, fired the 30,000, and two, she says, it was unpleasant, but I have no regrets. So,
yeah, and
I don't think that makes me a liberal. I mean,
the problem is that they painted Romney with this also, that in that time frame in the tech industry, I'm from the semiconductor industry, that is what was being done across the board by hundreds and hundreds of companies. And what I don't see today is people going, okay, what has Hillary done? She has never run a company. I still don't think she's addressed Benghazi. And, you know, she continues to stonewall on her emails, but no one's mentioning that.
Well, you know, Kevin, let's talk about that.
Whoa.
Let's talk about that, Kevin. Thank you for calling. Yeah.
No, I love that. There's no shortage of controversies involving Hillary Clinton, and I've been talking about that for ages. And it's interesting, I spend my life criticizing people, but obviously candidates have pluses and minuses. And when I talk about the Carly Fiorinas or the Chris Christies or the Mitt Romneys or the Jeb Bushes or whatever, people say, okay. But when I talk about what I see are problems with the Hillary Clinton campaign, I am just besieged with emails calling me all kinds of names, and it's somehow like you're not allowed to criticize her, which is remarkable but you know something, we could talk about all the things. I mean, Benghazi, a lot of people are rolling their eyes on like that. I mean, if it's about talking points, that's one thing, but when you talk about that all these emails that she decided which should be given to the government and which should be deleted, when these emails are public, should be open to the public, when there's so many questions about millions of dollars by foreign entities that went to the Clinton Foundation when she was Secretary of State. These are legitimate questions. And yet, if you look at the front page of the New York Times today, there's a new poll shows that trusting in Hillary Clinton has increased in the past 7 months. And since March, since the email flap began, people are saying that they like her even more, which, you know, I guess there are a lot of liberals who couldn't understand why Ronald Reagan was untouchable. I think there are a lot of conservatives who can't figure out why Hillary Clinton seems to be untouchable. There's no lack of reasons and a list of things to go after Hillary Clinton. So I'm not sensitive by being called a liberal. I mean, I understand that that's what you got to do. But all sides, all candidates have these faults. And I think it's up to the media to let people know the good stuff and the bad stuff.
Well, Ken, I do hear from some Democrats here in New Hampshire who worry about the quote-unquote baggage issue that Kevin raises, you know, this controversy and that controversy that seems to follow Hillary and Bill Clinton. And I wonder if that's something that, you know, Bernie Sanders or Martin O'Malley thinks might work for them, this sort of fatigue of constant controversy.
Right, Clinton fatigue. Well, the interesting thing is that nobody, I mean, we're talking about Jim Webb, Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders, and Lincoln Chafee, the former governor of Rhode Island, is also talking about running. Nobody has really gone after Hillary Clinton on these issues. Bernie Sanders has said that she's part of the establishment, she's part of the corporate class, that when you're talking about income inequality, she's not the person to deal with it. But nobody, to my knowledge, has raised, you know, the email flap or the Clinton Foundation flap, and that's probably driving editorialists nuts around the country.
Well, let's talk about Martin O'Malley. And Kevin, by the way, thank you for calling in. The number here in the exchange for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Ken, I do want to talk about Democrat Martin O'Malley. As you said earlier, former Maryland governor, former Baltimore mayor, who's making a lot of "I want to run for president" noises. And yet some have said, look, Martin O'Malley, you know, you were mayor when some of these very tough on crime policies were put into place. How's that going to affect your campaign? What do you say now? I want to just play a little clip of O'Malley talking on NBC's Meet the Press.
What's happened in Baltimore should be a wake-up call for the entire country. The protests that also happened in New York and Philadelphia and other cities. We have deep problems as a country, and we need deeper understanding if we're going to give our children a better future.
This now sounds like you want to make it central to your any campaign.
I think it has to be central.
So we'll see you, you'll probably announce in Baltimore?
I wouldn't think of announcing anyplace else. Baltimore, this has been a setback for us, Chuck, mm-hmm. but our story is not over. We are not defeated as a city, and we are not about to throw in the towel on our country.
Okay, so again, that's Martin O'Malley on NBC's Meet the Press, sounding a lot like a candidate and trying to, talk about this Baltimore issue, Ken Rudin, in a way that might help his campaign.
Well, he was asked, you heard in that tape, he was asked whether Baltimore and its experience of 8 years as mayor of Baltimore is a central issue to his potential candidacy. And it has to be. I mean, that's part of his record. And he did, for all the talk about zero tolerance and more incarceration rates, he did keep Baltimore pretty safe. He seemed to be very popular, overwhelmingly reelected over and over again. But then we did see in the aftermath of the Freddie Gray and the Baltimore riots, people saying that what Martin O'Malley pushed for, that zero tolerance, really led to a lot of anger and pent-up frustration with government.
All right. We will talk more after a short break with political junkie Ken Rudin. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Coming up, we'll find out how some presidential contenders are talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's gay marriage case. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's our monthly check-in with political junkie Ken Rudin on The Exchange, and we invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ken, one more question for you, please, about the politics of Baltimore. As we said earlier, you know, our nation's political leaders and those who hope to be political leaders have been giving their take on the unrest there. How do you hear this story becoming part of the political narrative? It seems like everybody's had something to say about this.
Well, yes. I mean, of course, Martin O'Malley is most immediately affected. And we did see Hillary Clinton give a speech on incarceration rates and the problems of the inner community. But in fairness, I mean, if we're going to talk about Martin O'Malley's policies of zero tolerance, we should talk about Bill Clinton's when he was president and backed by First Lady Hillary Clinton. He talked about stopping crime and putting more people in prison and things like that. So a lot of the policies that seemingly were popular in the 1990s, backed by Hillary Clinton, are suddenly unpopular. But what strikes me most about what's going on in Baltimore is how there are just two sides of this. I mean, you know, the one side will talk about the violence and the burning down of CBS and the loot, torching of police cars, and, you know, that many people are just using Freddie Gray as an excuse to loot and riot. And then there's another side that says, look, we have a history of being mistreated by the police, that we're constantly pulled over and stopped because we're minorities or black. And so there are two different opposing views on race that, you know, there was a poll that came out this week by New York Times, CBS News, that said race relations are worse than ever, and certainly the worst in Obama's presidency. And we've always talked about how this would be a post-racial presidency. Well, of course it's not. The issue of race is in, we saw it with Ferguson, we saw it with Cleveland, we saw it with Staten Island, we saw it with North Charleston in South Carolina, and of course now we're seeing it in Baltimore. And, you know, you could point fingers, you could blame this person or that person or this policy or that policy, but the fact is that we're still, as John Edwards famously said, and I can't believe I'm quoting John Edwards, but...
two Americas.
Two Americas, and it was not more... It was shown more clearly than it's been in Baltimore in the past couple of weeks.
Well, you mentioned President Obama and people's, you know, hopes that he would be a, as you said, Ken, a post-racial president. Let's hear what President Obama said about Baltimore this week. He's had a lot to say.
If we think that we're just going to send the police to do the dirty work of containing the problems that arise there without, as a nation and as a society, saying what can we do to change those communities, to help lift up those communities and give those kids opportunity, then we're not going to solve this problem. And we'll go through the same cycles of periodic conflicts between the police and communities and the occasional riots in the streets. And everybody will... feign concern until it goes away, and then we go about our business as usual.
Again, that's President Obama commenting on the unrest in Baltimore at a press conference recently with the Japanese Prime Minister. And Ken, let's go right back to our listeners. Jeff's calling in from Manchester. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. I think one of the number one things that's a disparity between public citizens and government citizens, or particularly law enforcement, is this concept that both David Souter, our former Supreme Court Justice, and John Paul Stevens, former Supreme Court Justice, said is indefensible, and that's the concept of sovereign immunity. The police and law enforcement and government get sovereign immunity when they commit basically unconstitutional crimes or a lot of crimes. So they've been held unaccountable in the courts. In order for, and that's not prejudicial towards any race, creed, culture, or anybody's, it is the law. It's a two-class law system, makes it very, a high, high hurdle for people to get justice if they feel they've been abused. I'd like you to comment on that.
Well, and this has become an issue for some presidential candidates especially, right, Ken? Rand Paul, for example, talks a lot about, you know, police overstepping.
Yes, I mean, he's one of the few Republicans who will talk about that. He'll also talk about the breakdown in the family and the lack of fathers and things like that. But yes, but Rand Paul is very discouraged the way that, that laws may treat different people differently. But at the same time, you know, I'm thinking with that question that he just asked, I'm just thinking about this, you know, the indictment by the state's attorney in Baltimore to charge six policemen with either manslaughter or second-degree murder charges. And, of course, everybody, many people in the minority community in Baltimore said, this is great news, we're excited. But most prosecutors I've seen quoted saying that this is almost, I mean, to quote the police union, almost a rush to judgment. The fact that it was done very shortly after the death of Freddie Gray makes you wonder what happens if, as the caller suggests, that the police are not convicted. It's going to be so hard to prove deliberate death of Freddie Gray while he was in custody. I mean, he was arrested, he was injured, and then 10 days and a week later he was dead. If you can't prove that, then what happens to the city then? The so-called the trust in the laws, the trust in the system of government, while it excited a lot of people last week, what happens if the officers are acquitted? And that's, I think that's what President Obama was kind of alluding to. I thought President Obama's speech was interesting. And if he weren't president, I think it would be a great speech because he talked about, you know, the problems that are out there. But as president, I don't think he has a solution. I don't think there is. I don't know if there's a solution. But, you know, I did hear him saying that the answer is not incarceration. The answer is not sending in more police. But he didn't tell us what the answer is. And as president, I probably would have liked a better answer than that.
Well, Ken, I've got a handful of emails here that have come in on, again, this increasingly crowded presidential race. Gene in Exeter asks, who is the John Huntsman in this crowd of candidates?
Well, if you're talking about who was the candidate that went nowhere, of course, John Huntsman, the former governor of Utah, basically was relying on New Hampshire and New Hampshire's reputation for being, you know, independent and so-called moderate. John Huntsman hoped to make a big splash in New Hampshire in 2012, but failed to do that. I think he finished third in the primary. But who is the moderate, the centrist? Well, you know, Jeb Bush, who I think is certainly the most conservative governor in the history of Florida, is now being perceived as this moderate, which is kind of remarkable. But that shows how far the Republican Party has moved to the right, the fact that Jeb Bush can be described as a moderate. So you have, you have the Chris Christies, you have the Jeb Bushes, you have maybe the John Kasichs, people who are acceptable and probably favored by the business wing of the Republican Party, but not by the evangelical wing. And that split that we saw in 2012 continues today.
All right, here's an email from Angie that came in. And Angie, thank you. I'm not going to be able to read the whole thing, but she says, I'm relatively conservative, so I tend to lean toward the Republican side. She says, number one, Carly Fiorina. Yes, fired people to save a company. Better than going belly up and everybody losing their jobs. Maybe she would do this in the federal government. She said, number two, the Republicans are all going to chew each other up and spit each other out. Worse for the wear. Angie says, I love Bernie, but I don't think the rest of the country knows him. Hillary is known. Angie says, I'm willing to concede the race to her now if we can avoid the mudslinging and negative ads for the next year and a half. I don't think that's going to happen.
No,
I hate to disappoint Angie. I really appreciate the email, but go ahead, Ken.
No, and I think we all would love that to happen. But basically, you have millions and millions of dollars not only to boost your own candidacy, but to put up these committees that will savage your opponent. Now, for all you know, when I was thinking of Mike Huckabee when he ran for president in 2008, Mitt Romney destroyed him with negative ads and some legitimate, some less so. But the point is, and we saw in 2012, everybody going after Romney for his comments like talking about self-deportation and, is he a conservative or not? Look, the fact is, there's no sitting president seeking re-election in 2016. The Republican nomination seems to be more valuable now than it was in 2012. Plus, it's an opportunity to stop Hillary Clinton, which seems to be the goal of many Republicans. So what I'm saying is that the Republican nomination is going to be very worth it in 2016. And when it becomes worth it, candidates will do and say almost anything in many cases, and that's not just a Republican thing. Democrats have done the same thing. Remember what Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama said about each other about, crime czars and slumlords in their battle in 2008. So Democrats can dish it out, and so can Republicans.
Well, Angie, thanks for the email, and Jean, thanks for your email, too. Here's one more. This is from Nancy. She says, please ask Ken Rudin about our Senator Ayotte's chances for a VP slot. Nancy says, I figure she's been running for this for years. This has come up before, Ken.
Well, actually, I thought about that, too. Of course, we have no idea who the nominee is going to be.
Right.
It's more fun to talk on the Democratic side who Hillary Clinton's running mate will be. But Kelly Ayotte is certainly a very powerful and rising star in the Republican Party. And I asked your friend Steve Dupree about that on my Political Junkie show a few weeks ago. And he said it's a great idea, but she's also seeking a second term in 2016. She's not going to run for both. She can't run for both. And she's just going to run for the Senate for re-election. So that takes her off the short list. But she would be on my list if she were for a Senate seat were not up at stake in 2016.
Well, and I did want to turn to another story real quickly with you, Ken, before we close out, that was the subject of intense interest about 2 weeks ago. That's the U.S. Supreme Court's hearing on gay marriage. And from your political perspective, how have you heard Democrats and Republicans running for president talking about this?
Well, there's no question that, I've never seen in all my years of covering politics, I've never seen an issue that where the public opinion has changed so rapidly. If you go back to only 2008, which is not a long time ago, every Democratic candidate, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Joe Biden, or at least almost every Democratic candidate, defined marriage as between a man and a woman. That was in 2008.
Wow, not long ago.
That's not long ago at all. Now, the Democrats have come around. Of course, President Obama was evolving for the longest time until he finally changed. But the Republicans have not evolved. There are some, like Jeb Bush, when Florida passed a marriage equality in January, he said, look, it's the law. I may not like it, but it's the law and we should deal with it. There are other social conservatives like Ted Cruz, like Rick Santorum, like perhaps Bobby Jindal if he runs, who were just dead set against it and said that just because the court rules one way, and we'll see what the court does in January, in June, just because the court rules one way, that doesn't mean we should sit back and take it. I mean, the court ruled on Roe versus Wade and abortion hasn't gone away. The court has ruled on Citizens United, but the left hasn't stopped fighting about money and politics. So just because the court will have a ruling in June, and I suspect that they will vote to affirm legalize same-sex marriage, it doesn't mean it goes away as a political issue.
Well, let's hear Florida Senator and presidential candidate Marco Rubio, a Republican, outlining his position on this same-sex marriage case in an interview on the Christian Broadcast Network.
You would have to really have a ridiculous and absurd reading of the U.S. Constitution to reach the conclusion that people have a right to marry someone of the same sex. There is no such constitutional right. Can a state decide to change their laws? Yes, but only through the political process, not through the court system. And that's what's happening now. The advocates of same-sex marriage refuse to go to the legislatures because they can't win that debate. They don't want to have a debate in society. They want courts to impose it.
Well, and that's what's interesting, Ken, about New Hampshire's same-sex law. The first law, or one of the first laws, I believe, to pass through the legislature, not through a court process. What do you think about the way Rubio is framing this? Okay, if states want to do it, that's fine, but this shouldn't be the law of the land. Is that an acceptable middle ground for Republican voters?
Well, it seems to be. I mean, there are two ways of looking at it. I think there are people like Marco Rubio, like Rand Paul, said, let's leave it up to the states. Scott Walker, who the governor of Wisconsin, who may run for president, is also feeling that way. The point is that a majority of the American people support same-sex marriage, which is a shocking turnaround from 8 years ago, but Republicans do not. Now, young Republicans do, but if you look at all 73 potential Republican candidates for president, not one supports same-sex marriage. So, and there's also a business we saw with the backlash against the religious freedom laws in Indiana and Arkansas. The business, the big business, or just business, it says that these social issues should be taken out of the mix. Once upon a time, these wedge issues did help the Republican Party. It helped George W. Bush in 2004, but that's a long time ago. People have changed, and the Republican candidate should come around to it, but they have not.
Well, and last question on this whole presidential political scene, Ken. We've talked about a lot of people, all the people who are officially in, some people who are still waiting. Scott Walker, you just mentioned, Chris Christie. Who else is out there, and what are they waiting for? Why not just jump in now?
Well, I mean, if you jump in now, I mean, I think it's more dramatic to wait. Of course, Chris Christie, given the indictments of the past week of his former top aides, and one person pleaded guilty regarding that closing the traffic lanes to the George Washington Bridge and trying to exact political retribution against the Democratic mayor of Fort Lee. That has hurt his campaign. And once upon a time, Chris Christie was thought of as a potential front runner. He was drawing a lot of crowds. People like his sit down and shut up kind of, you know, bravado. But right now, his numbers are fading. His support is fading and the money is not going to him. But, you know, you could still be Jeb Bush. You could still be a Scott Walker with a national fundraising apparatus and still wait until the summer, and I don't think anybody will fault you for that.
Really? Waiting until the summer, even if you're a bigwig like Jeb Bush?
Well, why not? I mean, I was surprised that Hillary Clinton announced as early as she did. She didn't need to. She could have waited, but of course, you know, she's not acting as if anything is different. She's still having her conversations with voters. She's not talking to the press, and Bill Clinton is not making anything better by saying, sure, I'll continue to have $500,000 speeches. but I mean, she's just acting as if nothing changes. And if you look at the polls, nothing has changed. There seems to be a coronation on the Democratic side, certainly not on the Republican side.
So last question for you, Ken. What are some of the big political stories you're going to be keeping an eye on in the next, well, week or two before we meet again next month?
Well, I mean, obviously, a lot has to do with if there's going to be a growing Democratic field. We got to see whether Baltimore hurts or helps Martin O'Malley.
Right, as we talked about. Yeah.
Again, all these questions about Hillary Clinton and you know going against the polls that say voters don't care. And we'll just watch whether I win that New Hampshire Public Radio trip to Paris. But forget about that. I'd rather be in New Hampshire than in Paris, because I want to see all these candidates.
That's right. You won't see them in Paris, Ken.
I mean,
My goodness. Only
person who speaks French is John Kerry, right? Wasn't he French or something?
Thank you very much for being with us. We'll catch up with you again first week of the month next month. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Laura.
Take care. That's political junkie Ken Rudin. Again, he joins us once a month to talk about some of the top political news of the nation. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.